Chapter 7. Those Who Loose and Bind. Somewhere in the Levantine desert, at an undistinguished spot where the sand stretches to the horizon in all directions, a group of young men in black, wearing tactical vests, gingerly tease back seemingly endless coils of razor wire. One of them addresses the camera filming the scene. "Thanks to God," he says, "we are now on the border between Syria and Iraq. We have brought a bulldozer to take down the barricades to open the route for Muslims. We do not believe in the Sykes-Picot Agreement." A little way beyond the forbidding springs of wire, an earthen berm marks the border itself. As promised, a bulldozer pulls up, diesel smoke chugging from its high-mounted exhausts. It begins barging a path through the tall bank. "We've broken Sykes-Picot!" one of the fighters shouts in triumph. Overhead, black flags flutter from buildings, vehicles, and the hands of jubilant fighters. Few in the West today have ever heard of the Sykes-Picot Agreement, an Anglo-French treaty that helped give shape to the largely arbitrary boundaries of the modern Middle East. But references to the pact are de rigueur among adherents of the Islamic State. Indeed, negating the agreement is central to their ideology. The state's purported caliph, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, has promised that his fighters' blessed march will not stop until we drive the last nail in the coffin of the Sykes-Picot conspiracy. In online videos, fighters display their foreign passports, open to the picture page, before tearing them into pieces. One issue of Dabiq, the state's English-language online magazine, carries a full-page photograph of U.S., Canadian, British, French, German, and other passports, with bullet holes shot through them, lying on the ground among spent shell casings. One of the passport rippers explains for the benefit of the viewing public, "We will live in one Islamic state. We will spread from the west to the east, and no one but great God will rule us." The destruction of both travel documents and international boundaries is intended to symbolize a rejection of the modern concept of a nation-state in favor of something else, something explicitly, defiantly pre-modern, an empire of faith. Despite the opportunities Ayman al-Zawahiri and others perceived in the maelstrom that was the Arab Spring, al-Qaeda's state-building efforts in the years immediately following 2011 met with mixed results. In Yemen, al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula managed to rule over Zanzibar for only 3 months before the strategic port was wrested away again by a combination of government security forces and Sunni tribes disgruntled by AQAP's harsh interpretation of Sharia. By the summer of 2012, AQAP's proto-state in western Yemen had for all practical purposes collapsed. But in other areas of the country, particularly bin Laden's ancestral desert homeland of Hadhramut, AQAP enjoyed a deeper relationship with tribal groups, and at least on some level, the franchise had learned the importance of currying favor with the locals. So as not to antagonize Yemenis any further, AQAP concentrated its fire on the Yemeni armed forces and tried to avoid civilian casualties, even going so far as to apologize publicly when its fighters killed health workers alongside soldiers in an ambush at a military hospital. Soon enough, AQAP would be presented with another opportunity to capitalize on chaos in Yemen. In September 2014, the Iranian-backed Houthi rebel group, which had been battling Yemen's government for a decade, seized most of the capital, Sana'a. President Abu Rabu Mansur Hadi fled south to the port of Aden, only to be forced out of that city too a month later. The following March, an international coalition led by neighboring Saudi Arabia began airstrikes against the Houthis with the aim of countering Iranian influence in Yemen. AQAP lost no time in taking advantage of the ensuing turmoil. It quickly overran Mukalla, a city of 500,000 inhabitants, the capital of the Hadhramut province and Yemen's third largest port. In June 2015, AQAP's founder and leader, Nasser al-Wuhashi, died in a drone strike. But the group's expansion continued. Over the course of 2015, it quadrupled its membership from 1,000 to 4,000 fighters, and to judge by photographs from a mass AQAP rally in Mukalla in early 2016, that estimate may actually be on the low end of the scale. In January 2016, AQAP took Houta, 20 miles north of Aden, and the following month, it captured four more towns in the space of just 1 week. By April, the Yemeni government estimated that AQAP had looted $100 million from the central bank of Mukalla and was earning up to $2 million a day from taxes on merchandise transiting the port. Disturbed by these lightning gains, in April or May 2016, the United States deployed a very small number of ground troops to Yemen with the aim of ejecting AQAP from the territory it controlled, especially Mukalla. In the face of Yemeni and Emirati advances, aided by Saudi Arabia and the United States, AQAP did indeed leave Mukalla in early May. But in truth, there is little to prevent AQAP's return. Many residents now prefer its rule to that of Yemen's chronically weak, corrupt governing institutions. Strategically, the group is focused on taking long sections of coastline and major highways, allowing it to set up a smuggling network to supply itself and the people living under its rule, which helps keep local populations loyal. Where AQAP governs, it always claims to do so in partnership with local tribes. Its propaganda touts its efforts to keep hospitals open, build bridges, and dig wells, something the Yemeni government rarely did in the rural hinterland, despite the country's degraded infrastructure and protracted drought. As a resident of Mukalla told Reuters, "I prefer that Al-Qaeda stay here. The situation is stable, more than any free part of Yemen. The alternative to Al-Qaeda is much worse." Meanwhile, AQAP makes little secret of the fact that it sees Yemen as a base for renewed attacks against its international antagonists, particularly in the West. In North Africa, the Arab Spring presented Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb with a similar opportunity for conquest. In 2012, as turmoil engulfed post-Gaddafi Libya, a country already awash in a tsunami of loose weaponry, AQIM seized an area of northern Mali the size of Turkey. In short order, the group set up training camps for its own operatives and those of other organizations, including Boko Haram, which would notoriously go on to kidnap 276 girls from a school in northeastern Nigeria. During the AQIM occupation of northern Mali, the group's leader, Abdelmalek Drukhdal, holed up hundreds of miles away in the Algerian mountains, tried to rein in AQIM's unruly cadres, advising them to avoid alienating local populations and local armed groups, and to be prepared for the inevitable foreign intervention. He explicitly criticized his own commanders for applying Sharia with extreme speed to a society that was not used to it, singling out public beatings, the sequestering of women and children, and the destruction of local shrines as activities likely to give rise to local hostility. "Your officials need to control themselves," Drukhdal admonished his nominal underlings. To the outside world, moreover, they should be silent and pretend to be a domestic movement that has its own causes and concerns. "There was no need," Drukhdal said, "for you to show that we have an expansionary jihadi, Al-Qaeda, or any other sort of project." Even with these precautions in place, he told them, foreign military intervention was very probable, perhaps certain. "We must not go too far or take risks in our decisions or imagine that this project is a stable Islamic State. It is too early for that." Around the same time, for good measure, AQAP's Nasser al-Wuhayshi also tried to pass on lessons he had learned from his own fraught experience in governing. His advice was similar to Drukhdal's. Had it been heeded, it could have functioned as a timely reality check for a group of militants Drukhdal had correctly diagnosed as rampantly overzealous. But AQIM's sub-factions, especially in the Sahel, the region of which Mali forms part, had never operated fully under centralized control. Drukhdal and Wuhayshi's words fell on deaf ears. In early 2013, French forces routed AQIM and drove its fighters out of most areas of Mali. The group melted away into the desert, but within 3 years it was back, doing what it had always done most effectively, mounting headline-grabbing terrorist attacks. AQIM fighters assaulted hotels in Bamako and Ouagadougou in November 2015 and January 2016, respectively, and in March 2016 carried out shootings at a beach resort in Ivory Coast and a rocket attack on a gas plant in Algeria. Late in 2015, AQIM announced that Mokhtar Belmokhtar's breakaway group, Al-Murabitoun, had rejoined the fold. The Bamako hotel assault was billed their first joint attack. In Somalia, Kenyan forces had made major advances against the strongholds of another Al-Qaeda franchise, Al-Shabaab. In October 2012, the Kenyans retook Kismayo, a vital trade hub and a key component in Al-Shabaab's financial sustainability. Within a few months, troops from Somalia and the surrounding region had retaken most of the country's major cities, including Mogadishu, eventually confining Al-Shabaab to remoter areas. In the years that followed, African Union ground forces and American drone strikes decimated Al-Shabaab's second-tier leadership and cadre of military and technical experts. But Al-Shabaab remained strong in its core areas and continued to attract recruits from all over the world, including the United States. By early 2016, the group had, like AQIM, reconstructed its capacity for terrorism, including operations well beyond its rural heartland. Greek myth tells of an ancient monster with a thicket of serpentine heads, the Hydra, it was called, and legend held that the moment you lopped off one of its heads, two more would grow in its place, making the beast almost impossible to kill. Since 9/11, Al-Qaeda has displayed similar resilience. Routed in Afghanistan, it rose again in Iraq, Yemen, Mali, and Somalia. In each of these countries, it has faced severe setbacks. But so far, it has always come back, even stronger than before. While the fortunes of Al-Qaeda's Arabian and African franchises waxed and waned and waxed once more, in Iraq and Syria, the situation was developing in a somewhat different direction. Zarqawi's Al-Qaeda in Iraq had become the Islamic State of Iraq. It would further mutate into the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, ISIL, in April 2013, and simply the Islamic State, IS, in June of the following year. But before either of those name changes, it would have to endure near death, followed by a stunning resurgence. Between 2008 and 2010, the Islamic State of Iraq faced a concerted movement to destroy it once and for all. While U.S. surge troops and Sunni awakening militias took care of the rank and file, coalition special forces moved in to capture or kill the leadership. The anti-ISI campaign came to a head in April 2010, when both the figurehead, Abu Omar, and the power behind the throne, Abu Hamza al-Muhajir, were cornered by U.S. forces in a house in the desert outside of Tikrit. Rather than be arrested, the two blew themselves up with suicide vests. Photographs of their bloodied corpses soon began circulating online, touted by ISI as proof positive of their martyrdom. With hostile forces closing in on all sides, the future for ISI seemed bleak. In one sense, however, these losses would ultimately help strengthen the group, because the raids stripped away the deadwood among its top leadership. Zealots like Muhajir and incompetents like Abu Omar tended to get themselves killed, while the more capable Iraqi middle management, many of them former officers in Saddam Hussein's sprawling security establishment, possessed better survival skills and had a greater ability to blend in with the local population. In time, these well-trained, ruthless men would come to form much of the top leadership in the resurrected Islamic State of Iraq. When it came to those who were captured, moreover, the coalition developed an unfortunate habit of keeping them together at a prison called Camp Buka, which soon became known wryly as the Academy. The main subject of instruction, of course, was jihad. as one ex-inmate, a jihadi who uses the nom de guerre Abu Ahmed, put it years later, "If there was no American prison in Iraq, there would be no Islamic State now. Bucca was a factory. It made us all. It built our ideology. Many of us were back doing what we did before we were caught, but this time, we were doing it better." At its height, the complex near the Kuwaiti border in southern Iraq housed some 24,000 prisoners. Upon arrival, captured insurgents would immediately recognize their comrades among the detainees. They could not have gathered in such numbers on the outside without attracting undue attention, but in camp, these men readily found each other and set about deepening their relationships and learning new skills. One jihadist, who was to become an Islamic State commander, praised Bucca in glowing terms. Camp Bucca was a new service proffered to the Mujahideen, so to speak, by the U.S. government and the White House. It provided them with safety, food, drink, clothing, and housing, as well as books. As such, Camp Bucca was an ideal environment for Islamic education. Inmates would immerse themselves in combat doctrine for a year or two and come out as ticking time bombs, ready to become cannon fodder or stir up conflict. And even those who were remanded into Bucca with no knowledge whatsoever of combat doctrine eventually got acquainted with inmates who would teach them, educate them, and guide them. Camp Bucca helped forge an unholy partnership between hardcore jihadists and another group of equally ruthless and dangerous men, former members of Saddam Hussein's security apparatus. Saddam maintained one of the world's largest and most lethal fighting forces. At the time of the Gulf War, the Ba'athist state's military comprised some 1 million troops. Even after years of cutbacks, in 2003 the Iraqi armed services were still 400,000 strong in a nation of just 26 million. Immediately following its invasion, the United States foolishly dissolved this standing army and declared persona non grata any government employee who had been a member of the Ba'ath Party. America thus removed at a stroke the one possible means of maintaining order in post-invasion Iraq. Worse, it pushed Ba'athists, suddenly unemployed and deeply embittered, straight into the arms of the burgeoning Sunni insurgency. Elements of the former regime cooperated with more radical insurgents from the earliest days of the uprising, reportedly helping Zarqawi to carry out the massive August 2003 bombing at the Iman Ali Mosque in Najaf that killed Ayatollah Hakim, along with almost 100 other Shia worshippers. Jihadists and their Ba'athist counterparts brought complementary attributes to the table. The religious radicals lacked nothing in zeal, but possessed little organizational capacity and were, for the most part, unloved by local Sunnis. The ex-Saddam operatives, on the other hand, suffered from low morale in the wake of successive defeats, but had excellent training in fighting and governing, courtesy of the former regime. Together, they made a lethal combination. But the blossoming partnership was more than a marriage of convenience. The two groups shared a common goal of restoring their Sunni sect to the dominant position in Iraq, and both were willing to engage in the most horrific violence and repression to achieve it. Practically all of the Islamic State's founding fathers passed through Bucca at some point. They included Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the Caliph, Abu Muslim al-Turkmani, his number two, Haji Bakr, a former Ba'athist colonel and eminence grise, who helped Baghdadi to power, Abu Muhammad al-Adnani, the Islamic State's principal spokesman, Abu Ayman al-Iraqi, a senior military strategist, Abu Abdul Rahman al-Bilawi, who planned the operation that seized Mosul, Iraq, Abu Qasim, in charge of foreign fighters and suicide bombers, Abu Luay, a senior security official, Abu Shema, the quartermaster general, Abu Suja, in charge of programs to support the families of dead Islamic State fighters, and many others. The most senior leader of Zarqawi's original al-Qaeda in Iraq to be imprisoned at Camp Bucca would also go on to help lead the Islamic State. Abu Ali al-Anbari, once a physics teacher in the former al-Qaeda stronghold of Tal Afar, began preaching Salafi jihadism in the 1980s, publishing dozens of religious tracts and sermons before finally being hounded out of the country by Saddam's security forces in 1998. And Bari went to Afghanistan to train with al-Qaeda. On his return 2 years later, he joined Ansar al-Islam, the al-Qaeda-linked group that would go on to shelter Zarqawi in the months before the U.S. invasion. In 2004, he pledged bayat to Zarqawi, who appointed Anbari his deputy and al-Qaeda's emir in the important strategic city of Mosul. Partly because of the connections he made during his 2 years in Afghanistan, Anbari also served as al-Qaeda in Iraq's liaison to the organization's overall leadership in Khorasan. In February 2006, around the time of the Golden Dome suicide bombing that precipitated the worst sectarian conflict of the Iraq War, Anbari traveled to Pakistan to brief senior leaders on al-Qaeda in Iraq's progress. He did not meet either bin Laden or Zawahiri face-to-face, but such was the tension between Khorasan and its Iraqi faction at the time that the meetings cannot have been cordial. After his return to Iraq, the Americans arrested Anbari and imprisoned him at Camp Buka, where his closeness to Zarqawi would have given him considerable status among jihadis and former regime operatives alike. Following his release in 2012, Anbari would become one of the Islamic State's most capable administrators, with a hand in running its intelligence, finance, and military apparatus, as well as helping to direct overseas terrorist operations. Anbari would also serve as one of the organization's most influential ideologues, delivering sermons detailing the organization's doctrines on topics such as the killing of non-Sunnis and the evils of democracy, sermons eagerly consumed by the Islamic State rank and file in the form of dozens of audio recordings. Anbari's career thus represents continuity all the way from the old al-Qaeda in Afghanistan through the early days of the anti-U.S. insurgency to the reborn Islamic State that would go on to rule millions of Syrians and Iraqis. As one Arabic-language newspaper put it, Anbari was everything to everybody. Inmates at Camp Buka wrote names and phone numbers inside the elastic of their underwear so that when they were released, they could recreate the deadly networks they had developed behind bars. On the outside, former Ba'athists soon became the backbone of the new Islamic State of Iraq. With their governmental, intelligence, and military experience, these men made themselves essential both to ISI's battlefield achievements and to the terror tactics it has deployed against ordinary citizens. In this respect, the Ba'athists resembled the Egyptians who surrounded bin Laden in the late 1980s and became indispensable to the success of the fledgling al-Qaeda organization. If anything, however, the Ba'athists were even more ruthless. Today, whenever an Islamic State secret policeman asks a 5-year-old child, "What do your parents think of the Caliph?" then has his whole family beheaded based on the answer, the Islamic State, wittingly or not, is using tactics of which Saddam Hussein would have been proud. One of the most capable ex-Ba'athists in the Islamic State of Iraq hierarchy was Haji Bakr, a nom de guerre. Even among those who knew him well, few were able to pin down his true personality. To meet the demands of any given situation, he was capable of oscillating from affable to psychotic. He had been in Air Force intelligence and, as with many Iraqi soldiers, when the military was dissolved, he joined the ranks of al-Qaeda in Iraq, linking up with Abu Musab al-Zarqawi in the Sunni heartland of Anbar province. Like the regime he once served, the colonel was far from fundamentalist in religious matters. Indeed, some more zealous members of ISI faulted him for going clean-shaven and being lax in religious practice, criticism he eventually sought to assuage by growing a beard and outwardly comporting himself more in accordance with Salafi teachings. But Haji Bakr's military and intelligence expertise was too valuable to ignore, and soon he began to rise through the ranks of the incipient Islamic State of Iraq. From 2006 to 2008, he was imprisoned at Camp Buka as well as the infamous Abu Ghraib prison. After his release, he became a senior military advisor to the two ISI leaders, Abu Omar and Abu Hamza al-Muhajir. One of his favorite tactics for serving his master's interests was to arrange for their rivals to meet an untimely end, just as Saddam's intelligence services used to do with the late dictator's own enemies. By the time Omar and Muhajir exploded their suicide vests in 2010, Haji Bakr had risen to the top of the Islamic State of Iraq's Shura Council, the body that governed ISI, and picked its senior leadership, and still performs those roles in ISI's successor organization, the Islamic State. From that pivotal position, Haji Bakr was able to engineer the accession of Abu Omar's successor as emir. It was still too dangerous for the council to meet face-to-face. Instead, like bin Laden and Zawahiri, the members had to communicate by courier. Haji Bakr took full advantage of the fog of war thus created to push his own nominee. He wrote to every member of the council, telling each one that the others had all unanimously decided to support one particular candidate. In the end, all but two members went along with this consensus, and Haji Bakr's man was elected. The man thus catapulted to the top of the organization was another Iraqi, an aspiring cleric called Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. Like his predecessor, Abu Omar, Baghdadi was not actually from Baghdad. He hailed instead from the countryside around the ancient city of Samarra, at the center of the Sunni triangle, where Zarqawi's 2006 bombing of the golden-domed Askari shrine was to herald a major escalation in sectarian violence. Baghdadi was born into an agricultural family in the early 1970s. Two of his brothers and two uncles served in Saddam's security forces, but like the young Ayman al-Zawahiri 20 years before, as a schoolboy, Baghdadi was known as a reticent bookworm, albeit one who excelled at soccer. His skills would later earn him the nickname Maradona, after the Argentine soccer legend. At college in Baghdad, he studied the Sharia and the Quran, before going on to obtain a master's in the study of medieval interpretations of the Quran. He joined the Muslim Brotherhood, a banned organization under Saddam, but soon left in dismay, having found that even the Brotherhood was not radical enough for his taste. According to Baghdadi's official biography, he became a professor at Tikrit University and served as imam at mosques in Samarra, Baghdad, and Fallujah, co-founding an insurgent group called the Army of the Sunnis in the aftermath of the U.S. invasion. This is almost certainly an exaggeration. Unofficial sources place Baghdadi as an assistant prayer leader at a mosque in a poor area of Baghdad and possibly an assistant imam in Fallujah. For the most part, though, Baghdadi was a student. After earning his master's in 1999, he began work on a PhD at an institution then known as Saddam University. But his studies were cut short by his arrest in February 2004. Even this happened by accident. Baghdadi simply happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. The house of a friend who was involved in the insurgency and who was the real target of the raid. Baghdadi's Department of Defense file lists his occupation as administrative work, secretary. One Pentagon official describes him as having been a street thug. In fact, he probably did not quite match that description, for there is no evidence that Baghdadi was ever a fighter of any kind. His jihad was clerical, in both senses of the word. Baghdadi spent most of 2004 in U.S. custody, first at Camp Adder, near Naziraya, in the Shia South, and then, for about 2 months, at the academy, Camp Buka. Among the other inmates, he gained a reputation for being quiet and withdrawn, although he did occasionally deliver Friday sermons and lecture the inmates on Islamic law. One jihadi colleague said, "I got a feeling from him that he was hiding something inside, a darkness that he did not want to show to other people. He was remote, far from us all." However, this remoteness seems to have afforded Baghdadi an air of impartiality, for the Americans would turn to him to help arbitrate disputes between rival groups of inmates. In December 2004, the United States released Baghdadi, apparently because he was deemed too low-level to pose a real threat. His detainee file indicated that there was scant evidence that he was even a part of the insurgency at all prior to his arrest. But if he was not already involved with the insurgency, he soon became so. He seems to have traveled to Syria to complete his PhD, but while there, he became involved in preparing jihadi recruits about to make the journey across the border into Iraq. Under Abu Omar, Baghdadi played a role in the group's communications, although precisely what that role was represents yet another subject of biographical dispute. On one end of the scale, he became a trusted confidant to the emir, drafting important correspondence, including Abu Omar's letters to Osama bin Laden, coordinating communications between the Islamic State of Iraq and its governors in the field, and eventually ascending to the organization's Shura Council. In another version of events, he was a post office clerk, responsible for receiving, storing, and passing on letters with no knowledge of the sender or recipient. Whatever Baghdadi's precise role, it is clear that prior to his promotion to the top of the Islamic State of Iraq, practically nobody inside the organization or out had any idea who he was. Yet ironically, Baghdadi's very obscurity helped ensure his safety. Few people knew for certain what he looked like. Indeed, only two genuine photographs of him are known to have existed at this time. So secretive was his regime that in high-level meetings, even ISI's top military brass would be told only that the emir was in the room, without his being specifically identified. Some senior commanders reportedly assumed that their leader was Zarqawi's old deputy, the administrator and ideologue Abu Ali al-Anbari. In any case, it would be difficult to challenge a man whose very appearance was a mystery. He was, in some sense, the inverse of Saddam Hussein, whose face was known around the world, but who was rumored to employ multiple body doubles for security. For Baghdadi and Haji Bakr, the first order of business was to purge the senior leadership and replace any waverers with their own loyalists. Those who refused to go quietly would simply be murdered. In fact, Haji Bakr, assisted by the ever-present Anbari, quickly created an organization within ISI with the specific task of assassinating prominent people who took issue with his and Baghdadi's leadership, senior internal figures, as well as Iraqi tribal and religious leaders. Thanks to the unparalleled training and networking opportunities afforded by Camp Buka, continuity in leadership had been assured. As Abu Ahmed, the former inmate, said, "There wasn't a void at all, because so many people had been mentored in prison." To some in ISI, however, Baghdadi's accession as emir, with Haji Bakr pulling his levers in the shadows, was nothing less than a Ba'athist coup. For these critics, jihadi shills acted merely as a thin veneer on what was in reality an organization now controlled entirely by former Saddam loyalists. One senior operative, who later defected to a rival militia, described Baghdadi's ISI as the Ba'ath state with beards and siwak, a reference to the traditional toothbrush favored by Salafis. "The Ba'ath killed our people," he wrote. "How can they lead us?" A satirical slogan online corrupted Islamic State's official tagline, "A caliphate in accordance with prophetic method," to "A caliphate in accordance with Ba'athist method." But Baghdadi and Bakr's merciless handling of opposition, together with the organization's undeniable military achievements under the new regime, have combined to silence most of the doubters. The Islamic State of Iraq's first big break under Baghdadi was to come not in its native Iraq, but across the border in Syria. By mid-2011, little more than a year after Abu Omar's death, the unrest was rapidly degenerating into a vicious and desperate civil war between Assad and various opposition factions. Baghdadi and Haji Bakr did not want to risk hollowing out ISI by allowing Iraqi fighters to travel over the border. Instead, they formed a task force of non-Iraqis, led by a Syrian, Abu Muhammad al-Julani, to explore opportunities in Syria. To avoid tarnishing its image by open association with foreigners, the new group called itself Jabhat al-Nusra li al-Sham, or the Support Front for the People of the Levant. but behind the scenes, in recognition of the Syrian battlefront's centrality, ISI provided al-Nusra with unprecedented support, splitting its own budget 50-50 with Julani's group. Around the same time, Assad began his amnesty for dangerous jihadists like Abu Khalid al-Suri. These men, along with hundreds of foreign fighters now pouring into the country, soon helped al-Nusra and Ahrar al-Sham grow into two of the most formidable militant groups in Syria. Haji Bakr's long-term vision, informed by his experience in Saddam's military, was even grander. He wanted to use the rapidly disintegrating state of Syria as a base to build up ISI for an invasion of Iraq. In late 2012, the colonel relocated himself from Iraq to a town north of Aleppo in order to oversee the plan personally. In the meantime, ISI was going through a renaissance in Iraq, too. By 2011, the last American combat units had left, and the remainder were in the process of packing up and going home. Iraq's Shia Prime Minister, Nouri al-Maliki, took their departure as his cue to crack down on his own political enemies, especially Sunnis, and the political system began to fracture along sectarian fault lines that had been kept under wraps for decades. Maliki dishonored Iraq's agreement with the Sunni Awakening militias that had done so much to decimate the Islamic State of Iraq. All he saw in these armed groups were thousands of Sunnis with guns, whom he viewed as a potential threat to his Shia-led administration. Maliki refused to pay their salaries, a move that created further resentment among Sunnis even as it took the pressure off ISI. Desperate to shore up his regime, the Prime Minister detained hundreds of opponents without charge. Most prominently, he hit members of Vice President Tariq al-Hashimi's security detail with terrorism charges that were widely seen as trumped up. Under torture, the bodyguards confessed to having participated in terrorist activities under orders from Hashimi. In the midst of this affair, while the last U.S. troops were leaving Iraq, Maliki visited Washington. At the White House, President Obama told the Iraqi Prime Minister that as far as the United States was concerned, the Hashimi affair was a purely domestic matter. To Maliki, this was tantamount to a green light. One day after the U.S. drawdown was completed, he issued an arrest warrant for Hashimi, who was eventually sentenced to death and forced to flee the country. In the months that followed, thousands of Sunnis were detained and hundreds murdered by Shia militias with links to the Prime Minister. Corpses littered the streets of Baghdad and other Iraqi cities, reminding many Iraqis of the bloodiest days of the Sunni insurgency. But Maliki was not done yet. In December 2012, his regime reprised the Hashimi affair with a different cast of characters by indicting and apprehending the bodyguards of the Sunni finance minister Rafi al-Assawi. In the face of Maliki's abuses, exacerbated by Iraq's failing economy, rising inflation, and sky-high youth unemployment, protests soon erupted. Enraged, Maliki ordered demonstrators to terminate their activities before we terminate you. In April 2013, in Hawija, his security forces made good on this open threat by moving against a Sunni protest camp. Television footage shot in the aftermath of the attack showed the bodies of protesters piled up in the streets, including at least one lying dead in a wheelchair. With Sunni anger at fever pitch, Baghdadi and Haji Bakr could hardly have wished for better conditions in which to reboot the Islamic State of Iraq project. They had already begun picking off militants formerly involved in the anti-ISI Sunni awakening, co-opting some leaders and assassinating those who refused to be converted. In July 2012, he launched a campaign called Breaking the Walls, focused on staging high-profile jailbreaks to release remaining ISI members from regime custody. These efforts would culminate a year later with an attack on Abu Ghraib that freed more than 500 inmates. At the same time, ISI stepped up its efforts to recruit more fighters from abroad. The group began producing slick, high-definition videos depicting the fighting as a sort of real-life post-apocalyptic Hollywood action movie, complete with explosions and bleeding corpses. Within hours of being posted, these videos would garner thousands of views. In the summer of 2014, the organization took a leaf out of AQAP's book and began publishing Dabiq, whose overproduced pages hyped the life-changing power of extreme violence. Dabiq has since disappeared from circulation, perhaps as a result of the heavy casualties IS has sustained in defending its territory against Iraqi and Syrian forces. Propaganda across all media glorified gruesome images of the dead who had martyred themselves. The group employed a small army of analysts monitoring traditional and social media channels, and a team of bloggers to document its exploits in various languages. Like many organizations today, the group even outsourced part of its media operation to India, relying on a blogger from Bangalore to disseminate propaganda to more than 17,000 followers via the handle @ShamiWitness. To increase its page views still further, the organization used sophisticated tactics to redirect online traffic to its own content. Between May 2015 and February 2016 alone, Twitter suspended more than 125,000 accounts for supporting terrorism. But IS remained one step ahead by quickly reestablishing closed feeds under new names and deploying specialized software to evade the blocks placed on it by social media sites. As efficient as online channels may be as a means of disseminating propaganda, when it comes to recruitment, they can at best only prepare the ground. When your goal is to persuade young men to leave the safety of their homes and come to a war zone to fight, nothing beats face-to-face contact. For this reason, IS has seen its greatest successes in a relatively small number of highly concentrated hotbeds of jihadism around the world. For example, 8 young men from the Lisleby neighborhood of Fredrikstad, Norway, population 6,000 of a total city population of about 78,000, are known to have traveled to Syria together, following in the footsteps of a charismatic local youth who played soccer in the neighborhood. If Americans joined IS at that rate, there would be 500,000 of them fighting in Syria today, instead of the few hundred at most who have actually made the trip. Molenbeek, the Brussels neighborhood that was home to many of those who attacked Paris and Brussels in November 2015 and March 2016, respectively, functions in much the same way. 3 cities in Tunisia are responsible for over one-third of the huge Tunisian contingent fighting in Syria, around 2,500 fighters out of a total of 7,000 or more. Over the border in Libya, the town of Derna has a history of producing disproportionate numbers of fighters dating back to the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in the 1980s, a tradition it is continuing today. Prior to 2014, ISI/ISIL may have had 3,000 to 4,000 foreign fighters. By January of that year, the figure had risen to more than 7,000, and by the end of 2015, it may have been as high as 31,000 fighters from more than 100 different countries, with the figures still on the rise. Moreover, IS has managed to maintain its troop strength despite a death rate of up to 10,000 per year, suggesting that its pipeline of fighters remains formidable. Over the course of 2013, the Islamic State of Iraq, renamed the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant in April 2013, began aggressively conquering territory in both Syria and Iraq. Once again, the Ba'ath-dominated ISIL took its cues from the tactics once employed by Saddam Hussein's regime. In rubble-held communities all across the country, ISIL would first open what appeared to be a religious community center, offering education about Islam. From among the attendees of its courses, recruiters would pick a few particularly fervent young men to inform on their neighbors and spy on any rival rebel groups in the area. These recruits would tell ISIL who the powerful families were locally and dig up dirt on resident notables to be used later for blackmail. In some cases, ISIL had its operatives marry into influential families to garner further intelligence. At the same time, ISIL would begin concentrating its fighters in the area, typically foreigners who would have less compunction about killing or subjugating the natives. when the local faction judged that it had amassed enough manpower and enough leverage with the local population, it would go public and seize the municipal government, violently if necessary. A case in point is Raqqa, Syria's sixth largest city, which was to become the capital of the Islamic State. Raqqa first fell to the anti-Assad Syrian rebels in March 2013. 2 months later, ISIL began assassinating the rebel leadership of the town, starting with the elected head of the city council. Anyone who opposed ISIL's rule would be murdered. One outspoken ISIL critic was found trussed and executed by gunshot to the head. With these terror tactics, ISIL soon compelled bayat from the local tribes. And by January 2014, it was firmly in control of Raqqa. The pattern repeated across northern Syria. Throughout the rapidly expanding area under its control, the organization began raking in proceeds from smuggling, seizures of government property, trafficking in looted antiquities, theft from Shia, Christians, Yazidis, government employees, and anyone else deemed an enemy, extortion, referred to as taxes, highway robbery, tolls, repentance fines, extracted from former police officers and soldiers, ransom payments, although it was equally happy to execute hostages for the propaganda value, particularly after other revenue streams kicked in, and in particular, illicit sales of stolen oil. Backed by a vast criminal oil cartel, ISIL was soon making more money in a week than Al-Qaeda ever dreamed of. One morning in January 2014, shortly after ISIL subjugated Raqqa, a detachment of Syrian rebel fighters arrived at Haji Bakr's hideout north of Aleppo. For the sake of anonymity, the colonel had forgone heavy security, so the rebels, acting on a tip from a neighbor, were able to walk right up to his front door, more or less unimpeded. When the rebels tried to take him into custody, Bakr, still dressed in his morning pajamas, appeared at the door and sprayed them with bullets from his Kalashnikov. The rebel commander returned fire and shot Haji Bakr dead. To a less sturdy organization, the loss of its shadow leader might have been a critical blow, but Haji Bakr had built ISIL on strong foundations so as to withstand precisely this kind of eventuality. And so, in the wake of his death, there was no discernible let-up in the group's rampage across the region. If anything, its conquests seemed to gather steam. In Mosul, with 2 million inhabitants, Iraq's third largest city, ISIL set up what was in effect a protection racket, passing the city limits under cover of darkness to extract money from residents and businesses before disappearing into the surrounding desert during the day. In June, ISIL fighters attacked the city with suicide car bombs and gunmen in trucks. Initially, they intended only to terrorize the local population, not to take the city. But the U.S.-trained and equipped Iraqi army simply dissolved, leaving ISIL in control of one of the Middle East's major metropolitan centers. Within days, ISIL had taken Saddam Hussein's hometown of Tikrit and was threatening to advance on Baghdad. By June 15th, ISIL controlled most of Iraq's Sunni-majority provinces, an area comparable in size to Austria or Jordan, and ruled over a population of up to 8 million luckless souls. Even as the group consolidated its astonishing rise, a factional conflict raged within the group itself. In early 2013, as the organization tightened its grip on the towns and villages of northern Syria, Baghdadi received word that Abu Muhammad al-Julani, the head of the detachment sent to Syria, had been reinforcing his direct contacts with Khorasan and was poised to declare his group, Jabhat al-Nusra, an al-Qaeda affiliate in its own right. Naturally, Baghdadi wanted al-Nusra answering to him, not operating independently as a co-equal branch of al-Qaeda. ISI therefore ordered Julani to announce publicly that al-Nusra was subordinate to Baghdadi. Julani and his Shura Council rejected that suggestion. Julani's position was a reasonable one, given the importance of maintaining al-Nusra's credibility among the Syrian population by keeping the al-Qaeda connection under wraps. For precisely that reason, Bin Laden had repeatedly warned against using the Al-Qaeda brand too liberally. ISI sent some of its commanders to Gilani to try to persuade him otherwise, but al-Nusra again rejected their advances and reportedly imprisoned a handful of them. Abu Ali al-Anbari, the former deputy to Zarqawi, had been close to Gilani, so close, in fact, that in correspondence, Gilani called Anbari beloved father, and Anbari referred to Gilani as beloved son. Anbari had warned Baghdadi of Gilani's intransigence and the likelihood that he would try to split off from ISI, so Baghdadi knew he would have to act decisively to keep al-Nusra in line. He moved to head Gilani off at the pass. On April 9, 2013, Baghdadi announced that his organization was changing its official name from the Islamic State of Iraq to the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, or ISIL, the Levant being a region encompassing Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, Israel, and parts of some other countries, and that the group called al-Nusra was part and parcel of this binational umbrella organization. Baghdadi explained, "We assigned al-Julani, who is one of our soldiers, with a group of our sons, and pushed them from Iraq to the Levant to meet with ourselves in the Levant, and set for them the plans, and drew for them the policy of work and supplied them with half of what is in the treasury every month. The time has come to declare before the people of the Levant and the whole world that Jabhat al-Nusra is only an expansion for the Islamic State of Iraq and part of it." To Gilani, this was not only unwise from a PR standpoint, it was rewriting history. He was adamant that al-Nusra was and always had been an al-Qaeda affiliate in its own right. The very next day, he released his own audio message expressing this view and renewing al-Nusra's direct bayat to Ayman al-Zawahiri. This fast-developing feud took the al-Qaeda emir by surprise. Suddenly, Zawahiri faced not one but three critical problems. First, a split between his Iraqi and Syrian branches, just as the rebellions in both countries were reaching a critical stage. Second, a very public admission that al-Nusra was part of al-Qaeda, in violation of the long-standing principle that local groups should avoid open association with Khorasan. And finally, an obvious challenge to Zawahiri's own authority and relevance, two commodities of which he was already short. Al-Qaeda's historic opportunity was in danger of being missed altogether. Zawahiri moved quickly to try to minimize the damage. The day after Gilani's message came out, Zawahiri wrote to both sides, ordering them to freeze the status quo ante. 6 weeks later, he released his final ruling. The edict faulted both sides for failing to consult him before going public, declared that ISIL and al-Nusra were separate entities, each a franchise of al-Qaeda in its own right, admonished the two affiliates to cooperate and share resources, and appointed Baghdadi and Gilani as emirs of their respective organizations for a probationary period of 1 year apiece. Baghdadi rejected this ruling, publicly accusing Zawahiri of acting contrary to the will of God. His chief spokesman clarified the caliph's objections, denouncing Zawahiri for splitting ISIL up along the despised Sykes-Picot boundary between Iraq and Syria, for encouraging rebellion within the jihad, and for doing the work of the enemy. Baghdadi sent fighters to confiscate al-Nusra's weapons, assassinate its leadership, and poach thousands of men previously loyal to Gilani. The defectors represented perhaps as much as 70% of al-Nusra's total strength. Gilani himself survived this onslaught, however. While ISIL moved to distance itself from al-Qaeda, Gilani thickened his group's ties with Khorasan and increased direct communications with Central Command. In an interview, he told Al Jazeera that Zawahiri had given al-Nusra a large margin to decide on our own when it came to the jihad in Syria. It was an assertion unlikely to endear him to Baghdadi, who still considered himself Gilani's superior. As the final piece of this plan to break the stalemate, Zawahiri appointed Abu Khalid al-Suri as his special envoy to the region, with plenary power to resolve disputes between rival militant groups. Zawahiri trusted al-Suri, having known him since the Afghan jihad against the Soviets. When al-Suri examined relations between ISIL and al-Nusra, he did not like what he saw. He described it as fitna, an Arabic word traditionally used to denote severe discord or strife. Al-Suri quickly took sides, issuing public statements denouncing ISIL, accusing it of wantonly destroying Muslim life and of acting as a covert front for foreign intelligence agencies bent on further discrediting the insurgency. In light of the rapidly widening rift within the jihadi cause, a number of efforts quickly got underway to knit the two sides back together. Zawahiri turns to the capable and well-connected AQAP leader Nasser al-Wuhayshi to mediate. Wuhayshi sent letters to Baghdadi and Julani, asking them to state their respective cases. Julani wrote back that ISIL's involvement in Syria risked blowing apart the anti-Assad insurgency and leaving the hated Alawite dictator in power. Baghdadi did not respond at all. In November 2013, Ahrar al-Sham and five other groups aligned with al-Qaeda joined to form the Islamic Front and issued a call for unity among all groups sharing their goals of ousting Assad and imposing on Syria an extreme Salafi jihadi conception of Sharia. Neither ISIL nor al-Nusra joined, but the ultimate intention was apparently to bring them in as a means toward reconciliation. Around the same time, a young Saudi cleric, Sheikh Abdullah al-Muhaisini, arrived in Syria to attempt his own resolution to the dispute. Unlike Abu Khalid al-Suri, Muhaisini's impressive social and religious credentials commanded the reverence of all sides, at least initially. The son of a wealthy family on good terms with the Saudi government, Muhaisini holds a master's degree in Islamic jurisprudence. Before his move to Syria, he preached in a mosque in the sacred city of Mecca and helped raise funds for jihad. From the moment of his arrival in northern Syria in October 2013, Muhaisini began mediating factional disputes, apparently meeting with some early success. In January 2014, Muhaisini published his Ummah Initiative, an umbrella proposal for an independent Sharia court to iron out intramural disagreements between the various jihadi groups. There was, he said, enough room in this arena of jihad for all of us. As an example, Muhaisini pointed to bin Laden and Mullah Omar's efforts to work together, an ironic choice of model given the hell through which bin Laden's repeated disobedience had put the Taliban, culminating in the Afghan group's removal from power and the near destruction of bin Laden's own organization. But Muhaisini himself did not remain neutral for long. Like al-Suri, he developed an intense dislike for ISIL. Perhaps unsurprisingly, ISIL rejected his Ummah initiative out of hand. In February 2014, he publicly denounced ISIL and blamed the group for prolonging the strife. At the same time, he became closer to al-Nusra. Julani took him along on a propaganda tour of Idlib province. It would seem that Muhaisini came close to the battlefront. He apparently sustained a stomach wound from a sniper, and he has been the subject of at least one ISIL assassination attempt. In March 2015, he became chief judge of the then newly established Army of Conquest, the Saudi and Turkish-backed jihadi coalition that has since made advances across Idlib and Latakia provinces. However, he has apparently not been called upon to resolve disputes between the members of the coalition, signaling that his star may now be on the wane. Muhaisini may have picked sides early on, but a number of other clerics, including Zarqawi's old mentor Abu Muhammad al-Maqdisi, put forward proposals similar to his Ummah initiative, and Zawahiri himself endorsed the central element of each of these plans, the concept of an independent Sharia court to resolve disputes between militant groups. The Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant rejected them all. One senior ISIL cleric, a one-time protege of Abu Muhammad al-Maqdisi, penned a tract implying that the formerly revered Maqdisi had gone senile. At a meeting with some of those working to broker a reconciliation between ISIL and al-Nusra, Abu Ali al-Anbari, brought a halt to negotiations by saying, "Either we exterminate al-Nusra, or they exterminate us." Anbari then repeated this formula three times, imbuing it in the minds of his fundamentalist audience with the significance of a solemn oath. ISIL wanted unity, but only on condition that everybody submit to its rule. Baghdadi said as much in an audio statement in January 2014. ISIL, Baghdadi reasoned, was no longer any old insurgent group. It was a real sovereign state, and as such could deal with any disputes in its own courts. Thus the root of the problem became clear. ISIL genuinely believed its own propaganda. It felt itself to be a real governing entity and therefore superior to any mere jihadi organization, including its parent group, Al-Qaeda. Finally, on February 3, 2014, utterly exasperated with Baghdadi's intransigence, Zawahiri publicly disowned the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. ISIL, he said, was not an affiliate with the Al-Qaeda group and has no organizational relationship with it. Al-Qaeda was not responsible for their actions. It was the first time Al-Qaeda had publicly discarded one of its own affiliates. Zawahiri would later say in an interview that it was better to have 10 decent followers than scores of thousands making the Ummah hate them, their deeds and their behaviors. True as that might be, Al-Qaeda now faced the nightmare scenario it had been so eager to avoid ever since it had linked up with Zarqawi almost a decade before. It was left with no meaningful presence in Iraq, now once again the epicenter of global jihad. Meanwhile, in Syria, the war of words between ISIL and al-Nusra had by now escalated into a war of bombs and bullets centered around Aleppo. In December 2013, ISIL kidnapped and later executed a senior al-Nusra fighter. The next month, it killed a commander from Abu Khalid al-Suri's group, Ahrar al-Sham. Then, on February 23rd, around 3 weeks after Zawahiri kicked Baghdadi to the curb, five ISIL fighters stormed Ahrar al-Sham's headquarters in Aleppo and opened fire before detonating a suicide bomb. Al-Suri was the main target, and he was killed in the assault, blown apart, along with a number of other senior comrades. Zawahiri issued a video eulogy for his personal representative, featuring the Al-Qaeda leader's voice, dubbed over pictures of al-Suri and other respected jihadi figures. The video opened with a clip of Mahmud, bin Laden's late aide, saying, "God prefers to see the destruction of the whole universe rather than the spilling of Muslim blood," before cutting to footage of Abu Khalid al-Suri walking with bin Laden in Afghanistan. On the soundtrack, Zawahiri can be heard offering congratulations for the martyrdom of Abu Khalid and condolences for this blind fitna that has befallen the Levant, for the sake of ignorance and ambition and aggression and greed for power, a situation Zawahiri compares to the bloody-mindedness that led to the assassinations of the third and fourth caliphs, Uthman and Ali, and in the 20th century to the collapse of the Algerian insurgency under the weight of its own excesses. Abu Khalid, Zawahiri says, was killed treacherously by extremist fools and ignorance, who would soon face moral death. All Muslims must reject them. Not once does he mention by name either Baghdadi or his organization, but it is quite clear whom he means. Ideologically, the running battles between Khorasan and ISIL went right back to the tensions between Zawahiri and Zarqawi, expressed most clearly in their 2005 exchange of letters. While every Al-Qaeda affiliate ultimately wanted to see the advent of a renewed caliphate covering the whole Islamic world and governing according to their concept of Sharia, not every jihadi agreed on how this should be achieved, or how soon. Zawahiri, following bin Laden, favored achieving the goal gradually. To them, an Islamic State, Phase 3 of the Management of Savagery Plan, could never be sustainable until a majority of its citizens could be convinced that it was the right way to govern. Indeed, building such public support was the essence of Phase 2. During Phases 1 and 2, there is no state or caliphate, so holding on to land for its own sake is not of prime importance. If a strong enemy arises, therefore, there need be no shame in pulling out and preserving your own strength to fight another day. Thus, at the end of April 2016, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula pulled out of the Yemeni city of Mukalla in Hadhramut province in the face of advances by Yemeni and allied troops. In a public statement, AQAP said that it withdrew in order to save civilians from further violence and to fight our enemy as we want, not as they want. For the Islamic State, such reasoning is meaningless. In the overheated minds of Baghdadi and his followers, the jihad has already reached phase three, the establishment of the caliphate. As an established sovereign entity, it is the duty of the caliphate to defend its borders and fight for every inch of its territory, which is exactly what the Islamic State is doing, at enormous cost in blood and treasure. What is more, in phase three, there is no longer any room for building public support. Anyone who opposes the caliphate deserves death. So, to be clear, it is not the case that Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State are working from different blueprints. Both sides still follow the management of savagery, but they have very different views on how far the plan has advanced. That, rather than any fundamental doctrinal difference, is why the behavior of these two groups diverges so markedly. Beyond the management of savagery's three phases, however, Orthodox Al-Qaeda dogma also holds that there can be only one Islamic emirate, with one supreme commander of the faithful at its apex. Currently, the emirate is the Taliban, and the commander is the Taliban's leader. Bin Laden gave bayat to Mullah Omar as such, and Zawahiri continued the tradition by pledging allegiance both to Mullah Omar and to his successors, Mullah Mansur and Haibatullah Akhundzada. There is no room for a caliphate in addition. To underline this point, Zawahiri renewed his bayat to Mullah Omar, affirmed that Al-Qaeda and its branches everywhere are soldiers in his army, and released a video of bin Laden in which the Sheikh says, "Our bayat to the commander of the faithful is a supreme bayat. It is founded on Quranic proof texts and prophetic hadith. It is incumbent upon every Muslim to affirm in his heart that he has given bayat to the commander of the faithful, Mullah Omar. This is the supreme bayat." For Baghdadi, this line of thinking was beside the point. As far as he was concerned, the Taliban had failed. They had lost control over their territory in 2001, and an emirate without land was no emirate at all, an argument that might soon be used against ISIL itself. ISIL not only possessed territory, it was the heartland of the original caliphates, and ISIL was governing it in accordance with its iron-fisted conception of Sharia. In other words, ISIL believed it had a chance to establish something far greater than Taliban-controlled Afghanistan had ever been, and Baghdadi was going to grasp that opportunity, whether Zawahiri liked it or not. Men like Baghdadi and Bakr, like their prototype Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, could not care less about consensus building. As far as they were concerned, citizens would either submit to ISIL's rule or they would be killed. Thus, Khorasan and ISIL, with their competing absolutist positions, had reached an impasse. It was increasingly clear that contrary to Muhaisini's conciliatory dicta, this jihad was not big enough for the both of them. It had long been apparent that ISIL was heading toward declaring itself a caliphate, an empire with a self-proclaimed mandate to rule over all Muslims on earth. Such a system of government had been the norm for much of the Middle Ages, and in theory right down to the dissolution of the Ottoman Empire at the end of the First World War. But a caliphate had to be governed by a caliph. Certain qualifications deemed necessary in ISIL's extreme Salafi jihadi philosophy could not be earned by any old book-smart farm boy from Samarra. Notably, the caliph had to descend from the Prophet Muhammad's own tribe, the Quraysh. So ISIL commissioned a Bahraini scholar, Turki bin Ali, to construct a genealogy for the would-be supreme ruler. Turki bin Ali could be described as the Islamic State's answer to Abdullah al-Muhaisini, al-Nusra and the Army of Conquest's charismatic young Saudi religious leader. With his youthful looks, half-rim glasses, and long, bushy beard, Bin Ali might appear indistinguishable from his millennial contemporaries on the streets of Brooklyn or Portland, were it not for his traditional clerical garb and the pistol he carries by his side. The Islamic extremism expert Cole Bunzel describes Bin Ali as the Islamic State's most prominent and prolific resident scholar, a description made all the more striking by the fact that Bin Ali was only 28 years old when he began his career as the Islamic State's highest-profile scholarly apologist. The scion of a well-connected family in Bahrain, Bin Ali trained under Zarqawi's old mentor, the venerable Jordanian Salafi jihadi cleric Abu Muhammad al-Maqdisi. Maqdisi appointed the precocious Bin Ali at the age of just 25 to his personal Sharia council. In April 2013, still in his 20s, Bin Ali responded to Baghdadi's proclamation of the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant with a tract called Extend Your Hands to Give Bayat to Baghdadi. In it he wrote, "We ask God for the day to come when we will see our sheikh seated upon the throne of the caliphate." 3 months later, Bin Ali published his tendentious genealogy of Baghdadi, in which he claims that he descends from the Quraysh through Hussein, son of the Prophet's cousin and son-in-law Ali, ironically two of the central figures of Shia Islam, both of whose shrines had been attacked by Zarqawi's suicide bombers. In March 2014, ISIL itself floated the idea of a caliphate by seeding through its social media channels the rather clunky hashtag @WeDemandSheikh Al-Baghdadi Declare the Caliphate. A few weeks later, Bin Ali published another essay, this time dealing with the characteristics required of the caliphate itself. He argued that it need not possess all the attributes of powerful historical caliphates, such as the Abbasid, which, at least in theory, exercised political power over all Muslims in the world. Instead, Bin Ali wrote, a caliphate need only power, authority, and control of some amount of territory. It need not hold sway over all Muslim lands. As Bin Ali observed, many of the early caliphs, indeed the Prophet himself, controlled less territory than ISIL did. Nor, contrary to the interpretations of some scholars, did all Muslims need to have a say in picking the caliph. In other words, in Bin Ali's view, all the building blocks for a caliphate were already in place. Finally, on June 29, 2014, the first full day of Ramadan, the organization's chief spokesperson, Abu Muhammad al-Adnani, announced the return of the caliphate, a hope that flutters in the heart of every mujahid. Adnani went on to make clear what, in his view, this meant for the world's Muslims. With this declaration of the caliphate, it is incumbent upon all Muslims to pledge allegiance to the caliph. The legality of all emirates, groups, states, and organizations becomes null by the expansion of the caliph's authority and arrival of its troops to their areas. With this announcement, ISIL became simply IS, the Islamic State. 1 week later, on July 4th, the man who now called himself Caliph Ibrahim, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, suddenly stepped out of the shadows and up a flight of stone stairs to the pulpit of the Al-Nuri Mosque in Mosul. The venue, exquisitely filigreed with Arabic calligraphy, was an auspicious choice, underlining the Islamic State's confident grip of the newly conquered city, while simultaneously connecting Baghdadi to the illustrious caliphs of the past. Huddled around the ruins of Nineveh, a city more ancient even than written language, Mosul has figured prominently in caliphates dating back almost to the dawn of Islam. The mosque itself, with its distinctive leaning minaret, was built on the order of Nur ad-Din Zangi, the medieval ruler venerated by Zarqawi. It was completed around 1173, making it almost an exact contemporary of England's Canterbury Cathedral. Baghdadi carried on the theme of stability and continuity in his own choice of wardrobe, sporting a black robe and a black turban, in imitation of the Abbasid caliphs, who ruled Iraq from the 8th to the 13th century, and of the Prophet at his conquest of Mecca in A.D. 629. As a student of Quranic elocution, he spoke elegant classical Arabic in a clear, level tone, betraying no trace of anxiety. The actual content of the speech consisted mostly of platitudes about Ramadan and the importance of doing jihad. But one passage stood out as a statement of the terms upon which Baghdadi intended to govern, framed in explicitly Quranic language. "I have been appointed your governor, yet I am not the best among you, nor am I better than you. If you see that I am right, assist me, and if you see that I err, advise me and set me back on the right track. Obey me as long as I obey Allah, but if I disobey Allah, you are not obliged to obey me. I shall not promise you what kings and rulers promise their subjects, a life of luxury, tranquility, security, and comfort. I shall promise you what Allah promised his believing servants, that he will make them rulers on the land, as he made those before them rulers." For a debut public address, it was an audacious performance, one that drew immediate comparisons to Mullah Omar's 1996 appearance in Kandahar, in which he stood on a rooftop, donned the so-called cloak of the Prophet, and called himself Commander of the Faithful. But just behind the high-definition cameras, the more mundane details of the scene told a different story. First, the ordinary congregants present had not come voluntarily. They had been ordered into the mosque by Islamic State operatives. Guards, armed with assault weapons, kept them in their seats until the caliph was done speaking. In the mosque's gallery, veiled women sat weeping, stifling their tears for fear of retribution. Even more striking was the absence, at this supposedly world-shaking event, of any important figures from beyond the narrow confines of the IS hierarchy. Just about the only people there to witness the speech in person, aside from the ordinary worshippers quaking in fear, were the same cadre of Ba'athist ex-Iraqi army officers who had been with Baghdadi all along. There were no prominent imams, no revered scholars, no tribal leaders from any of the vast territory controlled by IS in both Syria and Iraq. Indeed, many of these people would publicly decry the speech within days of its publication. But this performance was not for them. It was for jihadis from around the world, just like Baghdadi and his Ba'athist minders, extremists looking for a winning side, no matter how vicious it might be. By the time of the Mosul takeover, the Islamic State had become a highly organized governing entity. Its structure bears striking similarity to that of the old Al-Qaeda as it existed in Kandahar before 9/11. Centrally, it is presided over by a Shura Council, a Sharia Council, and subordinate committees covering security and intelligence, military affairs, provincial affairs, finance, and media. The Shura Council, to all intents and purposes Baghdadi's cabinet, consists of between 9 and 11 members, predominantly if not exclusively Iraqis, many of them ex-Ba'athists. Their responsibility is to see that the caliph's orders are carried out. In parallel, the 6-member Sharia Council functions like a jihadi version of the Supreme Court, making sure all branches of government function in accordance with the Islamic State's myopic reading of Sharia law, enforcing its decisions through a Sharia police force and religious courts. Meanwhile, the Security and Intelligence Council, established by Haji Bakr, is responsible for keeping Baghdadi safe and in power, primarily by rooting out plots against him and liquidating potential rivals in time-honored Ba'athist style. This pattern of government is repeated, fractal-like, in each of Islamic State's 18 provinces across Syria and Iraq, and again within those provinces at more local levels. When it comes to its war machine, IS devolves a great deal of authority to commanders in the field, making for a nimble force capable of fighting on multiple fronts at once. Tribal affairs departments are tasked with reaching out to the powerful tribes, winning or coercing their loyalty. But despite these complex governing structures, the big decisions at the top remain the preserve of a shadowy elite behind the scenes, referred to, appropriately enough, by the medieval Arabic term for the people who selected caliphs and deposed them, often violently, al-al-hal wa al-aqt, or those who loose and bind. Similar phrases are found in Jewish literature and in the New Testament. In Islam, the words carry the sense of ultimate power, both to allow something to be done, to loose, and to forbid it from being done, to bind. It will surprise nobody to learn that in the Islamic State, the men who loose and bind, like so many of the group's most powerful figures, are predominantly former servants of Saddam. Islamic State's governing style, too, reflects its hybrid origins. Harsh Takfiri religious laws, enforced with Ba'athist ruthlessness. Stores and businesses of all kinds must close 5 times a day for prayers. Practically anything remotely enjoyable, including a picnic in the park, is banned, as either a waste of time and money, or much worse, an opportunity to mix with those of the opposite sex. For the same reason, it is a crime for women to appear in public without a male chaperone. At all times, women must cover their bodies literally down to the tips of their fingers. Even female doctors have to wear veils and thick black gloves while operating on patients who must be female. IS patrols, a frequent sight on city streets, have been known to arrest and beat up cafe owners for allowing women to eat in their establishments without veils. Men have a dress code to follow, too, albeit nowhere near as strict. For example, the hems of their pants must be above the ankle length, supposedly because the Prophet never let his garments touch the ground. Many crimes and their punishments bear a striking similarity to those used in the Middle Ages, the era from which the Islamic State draws much of its extreme interpretation of Sharia. Thus, for example, blasphemy, homosexuality, and adultery are punishable by death, while slander and drinking alcohol extract a sentence of 80 lashes, and sex before marriage can earn each partner 100 lashes and exile for a year. Although, given the harshness of life under IS, many might see the latter as a reward. For many crimes, public flogging is seen as the minimum punishment. Homosexuals and male adulterers are thrown from tall towers. Female adulterers are stoned to death. Certain criminals, such as bandits who commit murder, are often crucified, usually after being shot or beheaded. In many cities under IS control, including the capital, Raqqa, severed heads can be found impaled on railings, with plaques listing their owners' alleged crimes. Some prisoners, like the captured Jordanian pilot Mo'ath al-Kasasbeh, have been burned alive, and pictures of their charred remains distributed as a warning to others, or an inducement to attract violent young men to the ranks of Islamic State's armies. Clerics, like Turki Ben Ali, have justified these practices on the basis of laws enforced in the medieval caliphates. But whereas medieval practice imposed a heavy burden of proof for carrying out such punishments, sometimes requiring testimony from up to 8 witnesses, it is unlikely that the Islamic State bothers with such niceties. In dealing with opposition, the state takes its cue from Saddam Hussein, deploying a web of secret police and informants to watch its citizens' every move. Like Saddam, the Assads, and a host of other dictators it claims to despise, IS has little compunction about massacring peaceful protesters or executing thousands of political opponents. Reports have surfaced of IS assassins slipping over the border into Turkey to kidnap and behead exiled opposition figures. With the advent of U.S. airstrikes, the group has reportedly become even more suspicious as it races to unmask those who may be passing intelligence to the Americans. Predictably, the state's repression has a sharp ethnic and sectarian edge. It has murdered thousands of Shia, Yazidis, and members of Sunni tribes who refuse to collaborate. The pages of Dabiq glorify the demolition of Shia mosques and shrines, some of which had survived centuries of warfare only to succumb to Islamic State's dynamite. The brutality does not end with those the state considers its enemies. Women and girls, some as young as 13, have been forced into sexual slavery or marriages to IS fighters. In areas where Iraqi forces have made advances, the state has used families as human shields, executing civilians who attempt to flee. At the same time, IS has worked to cultivate an image as a real government, providing genuine services. It has wisely retained municipal employees with the specialist knowledge necessary to keep the power on, the schools open, albeit with a revised curriculum, the water and buses running, and the trash off the streets. Despite its professed contempt for the existing frontiers, the state has made sure to curry favor with locals by putting Iraqis in charge in Iraq and Syrians in Syria. Its propaganda shows operatives distributing food to orphans, repairing roads and electrical infrastructure, cleaning the streets, providing cancer treatment to children, and operating nursing homes for older residents. It brands its healthcare system Islamic State Health Service, with a logo similar to that of the United Kingdom's National Health Service, and provides statistics to document the quality and widespread availability of health care in the caliphate. IS provides an education, albeit one mostly geared toward ensuring the state's longevity by indoctrinating the next generation. IS schools use fundamentalist textbooks, in many cases the same ones children learn from in Saudi Arabia, often printed out from Saudi government websites. For many children, secular subjects such as chemistry have been eliminated to make way for yet more hours of Islamic studies. At least one Mosul family risked reprisals by pulling their child from school, as we preferred that he had no education at all than the one IS is promoting. More disturbingly still, the state also coaxes children into its cult of terror and death, encouraging them to inform on their parents, training them with automatic weapons, and forcing them to watch or carry out executions. Even leaving aside the constant danger of punishment for a host of misdemeanors, daily life under the Islamic State is grim. Massive depopulation and hermetic isolation from the outside world have caused local economies to collapse and led to hyperinflation in the cost of essential everyday goods. The state's efforts to rein in the ill effects with price controls have apparently failed. In fall 2014, it announced that it would soon start minting its own solid gold currency in imitation of the caliphates of old, although the Dabiq article touting this development betrayed a poor grasp of modern economics, referring, for example, to gold and other metals as having an intrinsic value. It is telling that, as eager as IS has been to publicize the supposed benefits of life in the caliphate, it cracks down hard on anyone who attempts to show the outside world a more balanced picture of their day-to-day reality. For example, it has made filming in public with a cell phone camera a capital offense. IS has thus succeeded partly by following bin Laden's advice on state building and partly by doing the opposite. On the one hand, it has made a real attempt to govern and win favor from certain local populations. On the other hand, its brutality toward perceived transgressors has gone much further than any of its al-Qaeda forebears, and that is saying a lot. The Islamic State has elevated murder from a tactic to an end in itself, a vital part of its ideology, which the New Yorker's Dexter Filkins calls bloodlust and a form of psychosis. Ultimately, however, this very brutality puts a hard limit on the amount of genuine local support IS has been able to muster, a flaw that leaves the door open for the Islamic State's own eventual downfall. When the tide turns decisively against IS, few who have lived under its oppressive reign will shed a tear. By the second quarter of 2016, it had become clear that the Islamic State was on a downward trajectory in its heartland of Syria and Iraq. Over the course of the previous year, it had lost around 40% of its territory. Ramadi in Iraq and ancient Palmyra in Syria were back in government hands. The latter an important symbolic defeat, thanks largely to Russian, Iranian, and Hezbollah support. the state's red-bearded Chechen defense minister and key propagandist Omar al-Shishani had been killed, as had his two predecessors as head of the military council, the ex-Ba'athists Abu Mohanad al-Swedawi and Abu Abdul Rahman al-Bilawi. Baghdadi himself was reportedly wounded in an airstrike in March 2015, seriously enough that the leadership passed to others while he recuperated. More gravely still, in March 2016, Abu Ali al-Anbari, the Islamic State's most senior link to Zarqawi, was killed, resisting capture in a U.S. Special Forces raid inside Syria. The following August, IS acknowledged the death of its loudest and most effective spokesperson, Muhammad al-Adnani. IS has responded to the downturn in its fortunes by lashing out at the countries engaged in airstrikes against its positions, most spectacularly by blowing a Russian airliner out of the sky shortly after takeoff from Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, and by using gunmen and suicide bombers to attack night spots in Paris and transport hubs in Brussels and Istanbul. Collectively, those three attacks killed more than 400 people. As IS continues to lose its ability to win real military victories, it will increasingly look to strike soft targets. As shocking as these bombings and shootings have been, they have done little to stanch the hemorrhaging of Islamic State territory. On the contrary, the Paris atrocities prompted France to step up its airstrikes and bring forward the deployment of its flagship, the nuclear aircraft carrier Charles de Gaulle, to the eastern Mediterranean. But IS has a backup plan. Just like Al-Qaeda after 9/11, it has cultivated a network of affiliates in various parts of the world. As a self-described state, IS refers to these affiliates as provinces. Thus, in November 2014, 3 months after the start of U.S. airstrikes, Baghdadi announced, "O Muslims, rejoice, for we bring you good news of the announcement of the Islamic State's expansion to new lands, to Saudi Arabia and Yemen, and to Egypt, Libya, and Algeria. We announce the acceptance of the bayat, of those who gave us bayat from among our brothers in those lands, the voiding of the names of the organizations in them, their declaration as new provinces of the Islamic State, and the appointment of governors over them." To be sure, Baghdadi's announcement was, at least at the time, not quite as momentous as the caliph made out. The Libyan provinces were in reality confined to one small town and one neighborhood of the city of Sirte. The Algerian group was no more than a tiny splinter of AQIM, whose leadership promptly and publicly rejected IS, as did that of its sister organization, AQAP. Only the Sinai group, Ansar Bayt al-Maqdis, had any independent existence worth mentioning prior to the announcement. Significantly, this was the organization that a year later would destroy the Russian airliner. But the other provinces would soon gain in strength, the same way IS itself did, by identifying and exploiting power vacuums. In Libya, following Gaddafi's death in October 2011, two rival governments battled for control. The internationally recognized House of Representatives in the east centered around Tobruk, and the Islamist-linked General National Congress in the west, with its hub in Tripoli. Each side enjoyed the support of its own coterie of heavily armed tribal militias, creating an effective stalemate with a demarcation line running down the middle of the country. On the border between the two zones of control lay Sirte, Gaddafi's hometown, held until 2015 by Ansar al-Sharia in Libya, the armed group that assassinated Ambassador Christopher Stevens and several other Americans in Benghazi in September 2012. In May 2015, Islamic State fighters captured Sirte with the help of defectors from Ansar al-Sharia and proceeded to set up a government there based upon the IS regime in Iraq and Syria. The Libyan branch's methods proved no less brutal than those of its parent organization. 3 months after taking control, IS put down a rebellion by the Ferjan tribe and executed 57 of its members, 12 of them by public beheading and crucifixion. The group has also decapitated dozens of Coptic Christians, a community that has lived in Libya since before the dawn of Islam, and released videos of some of the murders. Strategically, Islamic State's aim is to seize as much of Libya's oil and gas infrastructure as possible in an attempt to create an illicit petrostate of the kind that keeps its comrades in business in Syria and Iraq. In the months prior to his death, Abu Ali al-Anbari, one of the Islamic State's top administrators, was dispatched to Libya to firm up relations with the IS faction there. As of spring 2016, the group had extended its territory dozens of miles along the coast to the east and west of Sirte, and was battling for control of the strategic petrochemical ports of Sidra and Ras Lanuf. Beyond its beachhead on the Gulf of Sidra, IS fought rival militias for dominance in Libya's second city of Benghazi, and maintained training camps in the country's western coastal region, from which it launched its attacks in neighboring Tunisia, notably against the jihadi recruitment hotbed of Ben Gardan, the town that Zarqawi had once wished was next door to Fallujah. On March 20, 2015, IS carried out its first suicide bombing in Yemen, killing 142 people at two Shia mosques in Sana'a. Since then, the local IS faction has continued to assault Yemen's Shia minority, evidently hoping to foster the kind of sectarian bloodshed that opened doors for IS in Syria and Iraq, a project undoubtedly boosted by the involvement of Saudi Arabia and Iran on opposite sides of Yemen's ongoing civil war. IS has not yet claimed territory in Yemen beyond training camps, but unlike AQAP, the IS Yemen franchise is not even trying to govern, merely to create chaos. In this, it appears to be succeeding. In December 2015, it assassinated the governor of Aden province, then attempted to kill his successor the following month. 2 months after that, it carried out a gun assault on a nursing home run by Mother Teresa's Missionaries of Charity, an attack so vile and cowardly that even Al-Qaeda quickly condemned it. In Afghanistan and Pakistan, the market for extremist groups remains vibrant but highly saturated, with many armed factions competing for attention. Still, even there, IS has made inroads. It is recruiting especially effectively among discontented urban young men in Pakistan's overcrowded cities, where unemployment is high. In 2015, IS declared the Islamic State of Khorasan, or ISK, the latest of its provinces. ISK, in turn, has set up training camps in eastern Afghanistan and possibly also one in the tribal regions of Pakistan. As in other IS provinces, ISK has focused on attacking the local Shia minority. It also fights with the Afghan Taliban in Paktika province, across the border from Pakistan's lawless Waziristan region. The process of peeling off splinter groups from factions aligned with Al-Qaeda continues. At times, Al-Shabaab, Al-Qaeda's Somali faction, has seemed close to switching its allegiance to IS, but it has so far resisted calls to do so. IS has also signed up some groups Al-Qaeda regarded as indefensibly violent, such as Boko Haram, a Nigerian terror outfit that waged a long and unsuccessful campaign for admittance to Al-Qaeda before turning to IS. Al-Qaeda's aversion to Boko Haram arose partly from a deep-seated racism toward sub-Saharan Africans, but it was partly also an effort to avoid getting dragged into a local conflict with little relevance to the global jihad, and to shield the organization from pollution by a group whose methods were considered purely vicious. The Islamic State, in its drive for additional provinces, is apparently more willing to overlook these details. On the other hand, northern Nigeria may yet prove fertile ground for jihad, with its poisonous combination of porous borders, corruption, tribalism, and some of the world's worst healthcare and education. In Southeast Asia, the Islamic State has attracted the bayat of the Abu Sayyaf group. Once an ally of Al-Qaeda, based in the southern Philippines, Abu Sayyaf has already started beheading Western hostages and Filipino soldiers. Like many of the areas outside Syria and Iraq, where the Islamic State has established a foothold, Abu Sayyaf's home region is poor, remote, and lacking in effective government control, hampering the Philippine military's attempt to eradicate the group. Takfiri Jihad in Southeast Asia has the potential to be particularly incendiary, given the prevalence of non-Muslims whom Takfiris, like the Islamic State, regard as legitimate targets. By the end of 2015, some 34 militant groups had sworn formal allegiance to IS, and a further 10 had pledged their support. It would be wrong to presume that all these groups are equally dangerous. Many are nothing more than criminal gangs, rather than full-fledged terrorist organizations. Some are tiny. Indeed, smaller groups have a disproportionate incentive to pledge bayat to IS in order to gain the publicity, donations, and recruits they so badly need. Nevertheless, some of these groups represent the thin end of a sectarian wedge that may yet topple governments across the Middle East and beyond. IS, like Al-Qaeda before it, has also proved lethally adept at inspiring lone wolf attackers within Western countries. If you can kill a disbelieving American or European or an Australian or a Canadian or any other disbeliever from the disbelievers waging war, including the citizens of the countries that entered into a coalition against the Islamic State, then kill him in any manner, the IS spokesperson Al-Adnani said in September 2014. Smash his head with a rock, or slaughter him with a knife, or run him over with your car, or throw him down from a high place, or choke him or poison him. Subsequent truck attacks in Nice, Berlin, and elsewhere have shown how effective such messages can be. Even if IS is defeated in Syria and Iraq, therefore, it looks likely to lead a long and vicious afterlife.